in at record numbers. Many years ago, I met a 90-year-old retired country doctor. For fun, we would talk shop, and he would tell me stories of his medical practice back in the day. One was the story of heart palpitations, what he described as a crazy phenomenon that had started when he was still practicing in the 1940s. He'd never seen anything like it before, and neither had his colleagues. They were all confused. He said it was as if someone were playing a joke on all the doctors. At first, everybody thought there was something in the water. Since he was drinking the same water as those in his town, though, that theory didn't make sense to him. Over time, the new advancements in hormone replacement became popular. He remembered the day when hormones became the blame for everything, and he didn't buy into that either. He knew it was a big pharmaceutical campaign to rally for a new, profitable treatment. This doctor knew in his heart and soul that palpitations weren't a symptom of perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause, because women had never exhibited symptoms of the change of life before. More on menopause in my first book, Medical Medium. In the remaining years of his practice, he never found out the answer to what causes mystery heart palpitations. I couldn't help telling him what I'd learned from spirit, that they had to do with the liver. The man's eyes lit up. Out of all the organs, the liver had always interested him the most. I talked about pesticides, such as early DDT.
"Oh, I remember that," he said,
then spouted out a recollection of how DDT was everywhere, part of normal everyday vocabulary. I told him that DDT had ended up in people's livers, and he said,
"It's most likely in mine."
"Why do you say that?" I asked.
"I used it in my garden for many years."
When I was finished explaining the liver troublemakers of pesticides, the viral explosion, pharmaceuticals, toxic heavy metals and petroleum byproducts, and how that all translates to heart palpitations, he pronounced,
"By golly, I think you're right."
By golly, indeed. The mystery heart palpitations that started in this doctor's heyday and continue today are caused by a jelly-like substance produced by your liver when it's occupied by certain troublemakers. Usually the liver doesn't get overloaded enough to produce this sticky gunk until someone has passed the age of 30, though it can still happen at younger ages. This unique substance isn't usually dangerous. It doesn't hurt you directly. It doesn't normally cause heart attacks or strokes. What it does is gum up the works. At first, the liver holds on to it to protect you. Before even that, the byproduct isn't sticky. It's just a build-up from a virus, EBV, feeding off its favourite fuels in the liver. Those usual suspects of old pharmaceuticals, petrochemicals, plastics, solvents, old DDT storage bins that we all have, toxic heavy metals and so much more. When we never give the liver the opportunity to cleanse properly, such as with Liver Rescue 369 in Chapter 38, then rather than getting thinned out and dispersed, the build-up continues to build up and starts to get sticky. This is when the liver will still keep it contained. One of its strongest drives is to not release anything toxic into the bloodstream. A liver in good working order will normally produce a chemical compound to help dissolve this sticky build-up. The compound is very astringent and bitter. You might have even tasted it before, because it can come up into the stomach with bile that creeps up there. This compound only works as a degreasing agent when it touches oxygen in the blood. The compound is like a match, and oxygen is like the matchbox it needs to get lit. Since high fat levels in the bloodstream drive down oxygen levels, it has a harder time finding that oxygen when the blood is full of fat.
It would be like if you were trying to light a match and someone were holding your arm so that the matchbox was just out of reach. Without that spark, you couldn't light your candle. Just as without oxygen, the liver's special chemical compound can't become a degreasing agent that breaks up byproduct stickiness. The liver can't perform miracles when we unknowingly hand it problems. We usually can't help contracting viruses or being exposed to pesticides. It's not our fault that we don't get an education on how to take care of ourselves for the long haul. How many times over the years have I heard that not even medical school teaches how to care for yourself? Too many times to count. So we hand our livers impossible jobs without realizing it, and one of them is to contain this build-up, among other junk. This jelly-like byproduct I'm talking about here is a specific type. It's not the normal garbage that your liver is trying to store away if it can't detox it. It takes the right toxins, the ones we just discussed, and the right virus, EBV, to form this particular substance. And you don't need to exhibit one sign of liver disease at the doctor's office in order for this gunk to give you heart palpitations. You don't need to show one sign of heart disease. If you were to find yourself at the movie theatre feeling a jump in your heart for the very first time, and you decided not to ignore it and went instead to get it checked out, there's a good chance that even with all the tests, nothing would show up. To understand how the build-up of this substance leads to heart palpitations, imagine big, wet snowflakes. On a day when the temperature is hovering at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the snowflakes drifting down from the sky will melt almost as soon as they land on the grass and sidewalks. They won't stick. If the conditions are right, on the other hand, and the temperature drops, the snowflakes will start to build up, creating a layer of snowfall. If the temperature rises again, the snow will disappear over time. When your liver can't contain its jelly-like build-up after a certain point, the substance leaves the liver through the bloodstream, overrides the chemical compound meant to dissolve it, if the liver were in better shape, and finds its way to the heart, where it sticks inside valve entryways. It's not a heart or a valve disease. Rather, with the right conditions, these little bits of jelly act like big snowflakes, piling up on one another, on a microscopic level too small to observe if you could suddenly see inside your body. As the substance builds up, it can make the heart valves stick slightly, sending the heart into a slight non-dangerous spasm, resulting in that uncomfortable feeling in the chest. The right conditions to cause this sticking, like temperatures dropping and causing snow to stick, include a diet high in fat, an overload of troublemakers, and the resulting thick blood. Fattier blood equals thick blood equals dirty blood. Fatty, thick, dirty blood holds less oxygen, and you want higher oxygen in your blood because it acts together with your liver's specialized chemical compound as a degreasing and dispersing agent for this jelly. The fine bits of jelly buildup in the liver that get released are supposed to be dispersed before they get a chance to stick to heart valves. Note that the oxygen saturation tests out there these days can easily show that you have adequate oxygen in your blood even when you don't, because they test on a macro level. What about a micro level? We don't yet have tests that pick up on that smaller scale, because medical research and science don't realize there is one. When they discover this nuance, they'll be able to develop tests that help determine if someone has enough oxygen in the blood to disperse an item such as this jelly. Don't confuse jelly buildup with plaque. Plaque in the arteries, smaller blood vessels and valves, is the beginning of heart disease. What we're talking about here is a whole different substance, one that changes with the most minute shift in the blood's oxygen level. That you can have both heart disease and this unrelated sticky residue at the same time. The oxygen level shift here is a much smaller difference than that between 98% and 99%. Rounding up to the nearest percentage point is not precise enough for this kind of pinpointing. For true precision, we need to go out to over 100 decimal places. Here's what that looks like. 98.999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999
saturation of your blood, there's a world of difference between the figure above and 99%. So oxygenation of blood, or rather lack thereof, is one big piece of the puzzle when it comes to this substance gumming up your heart valves. At the same time, you need enough viral activity in your liver that's feeding off toxins and then releasing them for the other conditions to be just right. Flutters, a jump in the heart, a skipped beat feeling, a fish jumping out of the chest feeling, a popping sensation that goes up to the throat, and more. There are many different forms that palpitations can take. Mystery atrial fibrillation has a lot to do with this jelly. When blood oxygen levels are very low, viral activity is high, and the liver is very toxic, even when the organ is not exhibiting disease. The jelly can become very thick and build up to the point that it causes this irregular heart rate on a fairly regular basis. Not every case of mystery arrhythmia is caused solely by the jelly. A rarer cause is when someone has a high level of toxic heavy metals, such as mercury, in the brain, meaning that electrical brain signals end up hitting those metal pockets and ricocheting down the vagus and other heart-related nerves, causing spasms or mystery symptoms that are neurological. Free flowing. How to avoid an out-of-rhythm heart? Think of the conventional medical approach to arrhythmia, a prescription blood thinner. That should tell you something about what medical communities have observed makes a difference. Now, wouldn't you rather go to the source and thin your blood naturally? I've seen so many people get rid of mystery heart palpitations, ectopic heartbeats, and other arrhythmias by cleaning up the liver and lowering the amount of fat they eat. If you suffer from heart palpitations and you're looking to a trendy high-fat diet to be your answer, you really need to find another avenue. Lowering the fat in your diet not only thins your blood, it allows the liver to safely release what's been holding it back. Chapter 19. Adrenal Problems. Medical research and science are unaware that our adrenal glands actually produce 56 different adrenaline blends geared to a number of different functions. Some of those blends are mild, namely the ones for actions such as talking on the phone, dropping off your child at school, checking the mail, putting together a list of what you need at the store, and doing the laundry. There's a world of difference between the liver soaking up that everyday kind of adrenaline versus the more normally publicized kind our adrenals produce in times of high stress, exertion, alarm, and sorrow. When it is this second type of adrenaline, our livers take special pains to protect us, since our adrenals must produce a strong brew of adrenaline to get us through betrayal, jealousy, hurt, pain, fear, attack, loss, confrontation, being stabbed in the back, having our trust broken, not being heard, and adrenaline rush activities such as skydiving, bungee jumping, and extreme cleansing.
Even someone making a wayward comment in the workplace because they didn't think first can get our blood boiling and give us the shakes because of the adrenaline surge it triggers when our brain registers a threat. The liver is there to clean up afterward. It's a natural process that gets us through life's ups and downs. With information, demands, and feedback coming at us faster than ever, we have a lot of surges of this caustic adrenaline nowadays, sometimes more, a lot more, than is ideal. The adrenals must work that much harder, and so must the liver. Each one of our livers deserves a bravery medal for taking on the job of adrenaline management. Extreme cleanse effects. With any type of cleanse, detox or diet we try, regardless of how popular or celebrated it is in the health world, we need to pay serious consideration to possible side effects that may not be helpful and may even be harmful. Liver cleanses are a prime example. They need to be liver-friendly. That sounds strange to say, doesn't it? When you're doing a liver cleanse, wouldn't you automatically think it's liver-friendly? You'd think that someone labelling it with liver would instantly mean it's safe for the organ. Well, not necessarily. And there's much more to it than that. When you're administering a cleanse or trying one yourself, you not only need to look out for the liver and its needs, you also need to be mindful of another critical part of the body, the adrenal glands. The Liver Rescue 369 in Chapter 38 does both. I remember once watching a friend pull weeds out of his garden. As I sat nearby, he told me that with so many responsibilities and commitments that month, he hadn't had a chance to tend to his plot. The weeds had gotten away from him. He kneeled there, uprooting the unwanted growth, getting closer and closer to his prized pepper plants. In the fertilized soil around them, the weeds appeared especially thick and strong. My friend gripped a massive thistle. "Are you sure you want to pull that one out?" I asked. "What if you snip it at the base instead so you don't disrupt the peppers? Aren't they the ones that win you prizes at the farmer's market every year?" "Yes," my friend replied. "I've won 3 years in a row. But I need to get this thistle out, or it will starve the peppers of nutrients." So he tugged, then he pulled, then he yanked as I sat cringing. It seemed he was trying to be as careful as he could at first, though he quickly became obsessed. Madness took him over. Finally, he put all his weight into it and uprooted the thistle with a heave. Only that wasn't all he uprooted. Along with the thistle, three pepper plants were now sideways in the garden bed, their roots exposed to the air, with clumps of dirt everywhere. Immediately, as a medic would tend to an injured body on the battlefield, my friend tended to his special plants. Carefully, he replanted them and did everything he could to make up for his mistake, watering them with care, feeding them with his own mystery concoctions of nutrients, as well as new ones he had never tried before. Despite all his extra measures, in his heart he knew he had made the wrong decision in fixating on the thistle. The hit his plants had taken was just too much. The pepper plants took a full month to re-establish themselves, and they never truly recovered. While the peppers did turn red eventually, and he was able to bring them into the kitchen and use them in salads, they never reached the prized size he needed. They were too stunted to bring to the farmer's market competition. People asked him what had happened, and he told them he had had to leave town to attend to some business. The next time I saw him, he said, "I should have just cut the thistle to the base, added rich compost around the peppers, and kept with the program. I'd have had the peppers I wanted, and maybe even better." When we're trying to cleanse poisons out of the liver, and we cleanse too hard, trying to get rid of everything at once, we disrupt and uproot too much. Many of the cleansers out there create a storm inside the liver, and they also tap into our emotional center, creating a mission-based madness that drives us to feverishly cleanse the liver to the extreme. In the process, what we should think of as our prized peppers, located in the back, one on each side, above the kidneys, take a hit. That's right, the adrenal glands are much like peppers in that they generate serious heat. Have you ever been outside in the cold without a jacket? You start wiggling your fingers or jogging in place, and it helps because this gets your adrenals to work. When you move your muscles, these heat-making glands send adrenaline into your system to get you nice and warm. It's a misconception that it's the increased circulation alone that warms you up when you move. Really, it's the adrenaline. One, revving up your heart to pump faster so that two, blood carries that extra adrenaline through your blood at a higher rate that has the warming effect. There are some hot pepper plants nowadays, and they generate a lot of heat units. We need to be careful we don't use them in the wrong way and burn ourselves. We've also got to worry about those two peppers in the back, the adrenals. We need to be gentle with them. With a misguided cleanse, not only does the liver take on more stress, the adrenals take a hit too. To begin with, they're usually stressed and weakened already. People with health problems normally have adrenals that have become slightly compromised and aren't functioning at their best. Many deal with recurring bouts of adrenal fatigue or ongoing chronic adrenal fatigue. When you cleanse the liver, the adrenals have a responsibility to uphold that no one knows about, to match the toxic material released from the liver with enough adrenaline to create a rush that acts as a flushing mechanism. That is, for every one part of poison that your liver detoxes, your adrenals must send out two parts adrenaline. It's a more liver-friendly brew of adrenaline than many, though it still has an impact on your liver. Medical research and science can't yet measure the amount of toxins released by the liver at any given time, especially during a cleanse. Nor are they even aware of this poison-adrenaline relationship. When it happens as it should, the least amount of adrenaline needed is used, because the toxins are released properly and evenly, without setting off alarm bells in the body. When the liver is forced to cleanse in a way it's not supposed to, on the other hand, as poisons flood the bloodstream, bells and whistles sound throughout the body as if the town dam has broken, or as if it's a 3-alarm fire. The liver itself sends out a warning too. Imagine that you've been tasked with removing boulders from the top of a hill. Your foreman forces you to take on one that's too heavy, and your first instinct is to hold it back, since it's so hard to manoeuvre. Unable to keep that up for long, you feel it getting away from you. The boulder starts rolling down the hill, off path, directly toward a co-worker at the base. What do? You scream to your work friend, "Move out of the way!" That's what your liver does too, when it's forced to release poisons in too high quantities at too rapid pace. It sends out chemical compounds to alert the central nervous system that a rogue detox is about to occur. The nervous system instantly alerts the adrenals to save the day by releasing adrenaline to protect the body in that moment. In this case, the adrenaline acts as a steroid compound to stop the body from reacting to any poisons as quickly as possible. It's still released in the 2 parts adrenaline to 1 part poison ratio, which adds up to a lot of 2 parts adrenaline if it's a lot of 1 part poison. In many cases, this adrenaline surge can make someone feel euphoric,
a cleansing high occurs, and for those who have strong nervous system and healthier livers and adrenals, the euphoric high can last for days and even weeks, preventing them from feeling the lows. In many cases, when someone is on a trendy extreme diet and starts to feel sick, she or he will be told it's a healing reaction. While it's true that we can have natural detox reactions in the right circumstances, if it's a harsh cleanse, then that reaction is not a healing one. It's a sign of too many poisons flooding the system at once. Not only that, when the liver is releasing large, unauthorized levels of poisons due to someone following trendy advice that's not geared to support the body in the right way, the adrenals will keep pouring out that two parts adrenaline to match the toxins. For someone with weakened adrenals, this is extra work that the glands don't need. The opposite of euphoria can occur, with lots of lows, as the liver ends up absorbing back most of the poisons. For someone with a sensitive nervous system, it's not beneficial either. The adrenaline itself, though it's there to stop damage, will start doing damage to the central nervous system over time. You may even experience symptoms such as the shakes, some light tremors, aches and pains, or dizziness. This adrenaline-nervous system relationship is one that medical research and science have only detected on a surface level. For example, for people who have Parkinson's disease, doctors don't recommend the use of epinephrine, auto-injectors, unless a shot is truly critical to saving a life, because they've observed that Parkinson's worsens with the use of epinephrine. Well, that's because Parkinson's is neurological, and epinephrine, another word for adrenaline, is hard on the nervous system. The adrenaline-nervous system relationship is also why people with any nervous system symptom or condition, or just sensitive nerves, don't fare well under pressure or stress. Their nerves are so sensitized to adrenaline that they can't keep a stiff upper lip. When experiencing a cleanse, you want it balanced. You're going to feel some highs, you're going to feel some lows, and you want it all moderate and within reason. Everyone has different health issues. Each person may react a little differently to a cleanse. What no one wants is a radical cleanse that has you utterly sick and ill, worse off in the end than when you started. I've seen this happen in the healing world out there for decades. As your body recovers for weeks and weeks afterward, it may feel like the extreme cleanse brought about healing. What's really happening is that you're healing from going too deep in the cleanse. You lose track of the fact that you're just trying to get back to where you were before the cleanse, and so do a lot of the experts and health professionals who advocate these extreme cleanses. One thing you want from any cleanse is a quick recovery. When the liver is forced to cleanse at a rapid rate, the adrenal glands can weaken faster, making it more difficult for someone to recover from a cleanse. The weaker the adrenals were to begin with, the longer the recovery takes. With adrenaline rushing through your system to address the toxins that have been pushed out of the liver, loss of sleep can occur too, which can stress the adrenals even more. During an extreme cleanse, people often don't sleep as much as usual because they're wired on adrenaline. Afterwards, they'll often sleep more than ever before because their adrenals need to recover. We have to protect our peppers, that is, our adrenal glands. No two are the same, not even inside the same person. While it's easy to assume that they're identical, and they may look the same when observed, the truth is that on a micro level, in size and shape, each is unique. Just like peppers, where two fruits on the same vine can have different curves and shades and heat and number of seeds, two adrenal glands are always a little different. I've seen thousands of adrenals over the decades, and in any given person no two are equal in strength. One of our adrenals is always weaker than the other, or if you prefer the glass is half full, one is always stronger. I say this because it's important to know that when doing cleanses and with any cleanse, the liver will be involved. The weaker adrenal is going to have to work even harder to produce the amount of adrenaline called for by the amount of poison being released. In fact, with anything we do in life, that weaker adrenal gland is going to have to work a little harder. It's that much more important, then, to take care of the pair. In addition to the healing information in part 4 of this book, you'll find more on how to do that in the chapter Adrenal Fatigue in Medical Medium. Adrenaline Neutralization. Let's look more closely at the adrenaline-liver relationship in our everyday lives when we aren't going through cleanses. Whenever there's excess adrenaline in the bloodstream, the liver must try to absorb and neutralize the hormone. And that's both a miraculous process and a big job. Sometimes too big a job if we're not careful. Though stress is usually considered a bad word, a certain amount of it is actually good. It keeps us motivated and moving forward and engaged with what I call our purpose plus. As I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter, a certain amount of adrenaline too is healthy and natural. For critical information on using stress to your advantage, see life-changing foods. It's an overabundance of stress, as well as overstimulation, dangerous cleanses, adrenaline rush activities, and going too long between meals that trigger our adrenals to squeeze out continual spurts of excess adrenaline, which are toxic and corrosive to the nervous system and the rest of the body, if left unchecked. The adrenals also release cortisol, which is like the good kid tagging along with the bad kid, adrenaline. When adrenaline is neutralized and behaves, cortisol evens out and becomes more reasonable and useful. If cortisol is hanging out with adrenaline on the night before Halloween, chances are cortisol is going to follow its lead and throw around eggs and toilet paper rolls. Let's always remember that the toxic, corrosive nature of unchecked excess adrenaline is not because our bodies are out to get us. Without adrenaline's life-saving functions, we wouldn't be here. It's what we're up against in this demanding world, not a flaw of our bodies, that's responsible for the floods of adrenaline we face. Immune cells such as lymphocytes, monocytes, basophils, and neutrophils throughout the entire body are counting on the liver when adrenaline comes rushing out of the adrenal glands. These components of the immune system are nervous, and they run and hide because they don't want to be scorched. They know they're at risk of getting injured and hindered by adrenaline, so they're relying on the liver to take the hit. The liver's immune system must be the strongest and smartest in the body, with highly intelligent white blood cells protected by a filmy shield produced by a chemical function of the liver that is undiscovered by medical research and science, and that uses an amino acid, a unique mineral salt, and a liver cell protein to help immune cells withstand being scorched by adrenaline to a degree. A liver in good working order can indeed protect the spleen and the entire immune system. In response to adrenaline surges, the liver, gracious, courageous savior of the body, acts as a sponge. Adrenaline enters in virtually any possible way, flowing into the liver through the hepatic portal vein and the hepatic artery, getting absorbed through pores all around the liver, as well as entering from adjacent lymphatic vessels. It doesn't have manners, it doesn't knock on the door, it breaks it down. The liver absorbs the surplus hormone to prevent damage elsewhere. It's a sacrifice, since adrenaline
doesn't help out liver lobule elves. Excess adrenaline that your liver soaks up is also enemy to your liver's personalized immune system. An alarm bell rings, different from the alarm when the liver releases too many poisons at once, to alert your body that your liver's immune system is compromised and that many tasks need to be taken care of immediately, like liver immune cells running to protect important assets as a mother would run to a baby in a flood. The elves start hup-toing and a miraculous chemical function starts to take action, producing a natural solvent-like agent that works to protect us. The building blocks of this chemical compound are old, non-useful hormones that the liver has collected, neutralized, and altered over time. These are normal hormones the body produced in the past, such as sex hormones and stress hormones, that lived out their original purpose, as well as hormones that we get from troublemaker foods, such as eggs and dairy. Whenever the liver finds these rogue hormones in the bloodstream, its plasma-producing cells trap them, diffuse them, and break them down to prepare them for their new critical responsibility. The next time we have an adrenal spike, they have a chance to live out that responsibility. When the alarm bell rings, the liver plasma cells activate and set free the old hormones, setting off the chemical reaction that transforms them into that solvent-like agent. Say you're experiencing a lot of fear or stress, falling in love, falling out of love, or going through anger, betrayal, hurt, sorrow, worry, or life's ups and downs, whether good or bad. Your adrenal glands are going to react by spurting out lots of cortisol and adrenaline to support you with fight or flight stamina. The body knows that the price you'll pay for that support is the damage too much of these hormones can do on a physical, mental, or even soul level. If rogue adrenaline touches a precious white blood cell from the liver's immune system, it will injure it. If rogue adrenaline touches the brain or intestinal lining, it will damage them. If it gets into the bones, it can cause them to become fragile and thin. Alopecia, caused by the adrenals becoming weakened, getting out of balance in their hormone production and underproducing a specific hormone, can worsen as adrenaline spikes weaken the glands further. Adrenaline spikes can exacerbate existing depression or bring it on in the first place. It can also fuel pathogens inside the liver, including viruses such as EBV, shingles, and HHV6. There's one agent that can stop all this: the balance built into the body to prevent damage. The new chemical compound formed from old, reconstructed hormones. Once released, this agent's job is to be both bait and trap for the fresh excess cortisol and adrenaline. These new rogue hormones sense familiarity in the old ones and gravitate toward them with the idea that they'll be stronger together. If you don't think a hormone can think for itself, think again. Within biochemicals such as hormones is immeasurable data that cannot be decoded by the science or computers of today, and will never be. If the human race survives the hatred, greed, and jealousy that propels it into wars and other acts of destruction, and we're still around 1,000 years from now, they still won't have it decoded. The amount of information inside a hormone is so vast that it's like its own universe. Some of that information directs hormones to be guided by the energy of the body and plugged into the energy of the human soul. It's why hormones are so tied up in emotions, and one reason why adrenaline is released when your soul is scared. When the new and old hormones bump up against each other, the old hormones' gluey quality grabs onto the new hormones like a sticky floor. Less quick and agile now,
the new hormones become stuck. Those old hormones bind onto them like nothing else can. It's a case of like fighting like, as when people cleanse their faces with oil or use mushrooms to heal a fungal problem. When these like hormones bind into each other, the fresh, excess stress hormones from episodes of raw, intense emotions or other extreme experiences binding with the old stored hormones that have been remade, a miraculous chemical reaction occurs. They become one. Together, these hormones are quite the pair. The fresh adrenaline and cortisol spark life into the old hormones, while the old hormones spark death into the fresh ones, dying down the information of fear, chaos, loss, betrayal, hurt, sorrow, and pressure. The end result is that the old hormones diffuse the new ones. They're the roller coaster ride stoppers. They're the brick wall. Bonded together, a balance occurs. The liver now detects the excess adrenaline and cortisol as being within an acceptable neutral zone, no longer dangerous and therefore ready to be excreted or flushed out to the kidneys. If the liver is working very well and at the top of its game. As you know by now, this isn't always the case. When the liver gets overloaded, for any of the various reasons described in this audiobook, its capacity to neutralize adrenaline and cortisol diminishes. Its ability to be the protective parent wanes. In an in-between state, the liver is still able to process some of the old hormone, and then it's forced to store the rest. If the liver is more beaten down, then it will store nearly all of the bonded hormone compound in special compartments within itself. That storage is in the hopes that someday the liver will catch a break and get a chance to release the compound for elimination from your body. When the liver doesn't catch that break, the bonded hormone compound becomes another stagnant waste item, taking up space inside the organ. As you heard in Chapter 12, when the liver has too much to store, the result is usually weight gain. When weakened, the liver can also lose its ability to perform its hormone neutralization responsibility. It will still help out as much as it can, though it won't be perfect, leaving some of the adrenaline free to do its caustic damage to the liver and beyond. So many people who experience a time of betrayal, jealousy, hurt, pain, sorrow, negligence, irresponsible or narcissistic treatment, or another adrenal release, will experience a bout of adrenal fatigue afterward, or the digestive system will get sensitive as the liver weakens in the moment, busy soaking up adrenaline, not to mention that any unneutralized adrenaline that gets by is extremely corrosive to the intestinal linings and stomach. Because of the fuel that unchecked adrenaline is to pathogens, it's not uncommon to be listless and fatigued and experience malaise. To have a small bout of low-grade mono from awakened EBV or a low-grade shingles outbreak or even small eczema flare. After a tough situation such as the loss of a loved one, a broken heart or a bad breakup with a friend or partner, the liver's immune system that usually keeps viruses such as EBV contained weakens in those moments of adrenal stress. During an extreme cleanse, the liver is faced with a choice amid a storm of competing alarm bells. Release old, stored-up hormones to go and bind onto all the excess adrenaline and neutralize it so it won't do its caustic damage. Or don't, because the brain signaled the adrenals to release that adrenaline for a reason, to shield the body from the poisons forced out of the liver. The adrenaline is there as an internal shock to the system, like a shot from an epinephrine auto-injector delivered after a bee sting, there to act as an anti-inflammatory to stop the body's reaction to the venom. The liver, ever the mama bear, knows what's most important in this case, to let the adrenaline do its job, and so it makes that critical move of holding back the stored hormones that would diffuse the adrenaline. Doing so, the liver must take the hit of a lifetime when the adrenaline eventually comes flooding into the liver at full strength through the bloodstream. It's one reason why you can't always trust a liver cleanse to be liver-friendly. If it's a man-made cleanse, derived from myths and theories, and it has poisons dumping out of your liver by the bucketful, causing twice that amount of adrenaline to be pumped out to match it, then your liver is absorbing the full hit of active adrenaline along with the poisons that have left the liver. And that's very liver unfriendly indeed. It would be easy to think that a diet high in fat provides a buffer in the bloodstream from toxic adrenaline. Quite the contrary. Instead, fat suspends the adrenaline, keeping it in the body long term. Unable to be sponged up, diffused, stored, or eliminated through the urine, as it usually is, this fat-suspended adrenaline holds on to the information that went along with its release. That means a fatty liver, or sluggish liver, which translates to extra fat in the bloodstream, also keeps heightened emotions active, like the moment at the office when you found out that you'd been left out of a critical meeting. It's a secret to why we sometimes find ourselves unable to let go of certain grievances. Clean up the liver and let go of the fat, and the liver can finally process the adrenaline to shield you from reliving the experience over and over again. Stronger for it. Our adrenal glands and livers are incredibly resilient when we do the right thing. If you're not aware of how your adrenals and liver coexist, then you can make more mistakes and step on more landmines. The adrenals especially are extremely forgiving. Realizing how they function during cleanses and hard times is how we discover ways to take a little better care of them. Sometimes just a little attention, a little understanding can go a long way. It's when people don't understand how the adrenals work that they get on a slippery slope of trouble. What holds so many back is that the attempted insights into the adrenals out there don't make sense, because these glands are barely understood in the first place. You can only be stronger for the information here. The knowledge alone of the liver's role in supporting the adrenals can strengthen the glands. When you take it a step further and look out for your liver with the different measures in this book, you look out for your adrenals and save them from stress. It's not about living in a bubble and avoiding every conflict or difficult emotion. You have a fundamental right to go through those challenges. You also have a fundamental right to access the wisdom they offer and to walk away better for them, not weaker. Our bodies know how to do this, if we can only witness and work with their true needs. Chapter 20. Chemical and Food Sensitivities. Chemical sensitivities are incredibly frustrating for the people who deal with them. Part of that is physical suffering. The other large part is encountering an unsympathetic world. The average person who's never had to deal with a sensitivity will view someone with sensitivities as the ultimate hypochondriac, or just think they're stark crazy. Unless there's a visible allergic reaction, like someone with a peanut allergy being rushed to the hospital after turning blue from a closed throat that's blocking airways, it's hard for an observer who hasn't been there to identify. A peanut allergy is really a toxin sensitivity, by the way. Anaphylactic shock, asthma attacks, hives, these reactions only describe one segment of the population. Chemical sensitivity sufferers' reactions are very often invisible to the outside eye, making it challenging for these people to find advocates. Instead, they're often told that they're making up their sensitivities or looking for attention, or that it's a psychological problem. They may be treated with an eye roll or a sigh or teasing. They may even be told they're attracting or manifesting the issue. What we really need to do is find compassion. The people who deal with chemical sensitivities know how real they are. They're very, very difficult. When the sensitivities are moderate to extreme, individuals will often confine themselves to home because it feels like the only safe place. Some are in a catch-22 because the house or apartment where they live sets off their sensitivities too, whether because of a lingering carpet cleaning fragrance, outgassing construction materials, or another chemical presence in the home. Since the outside world has its own threats, often unpredictable ones, these people feel they have nowhere safe to go. A different world. Chemical sensitivities tend to vary from person to person and also from time to time for the same person. It's almost as if these sensitivities move and shift, and the condition alters. Out of nowhere, you may need to change soaps. One minute you're sensitive to perfume, the next it's hairspray, and if you've never been sensitive to your own all-natural shampoo, next thing you know, you could be. The inconsistency and unpredictability are part of the difficulty. You may be one of those people who finds your sensitivity manageable. You learned, for example, to avoid plug-in air fresheners when you can, and you get by. That's a mild sensitivity. Then there's the person who has to avoid multiple items. Conventional hairsprays, colognes, perfumes, candles, fragranced detergents, fabric softener, cleaning solutions, and yes, air fresheners, which many people can't tolerate, and rightfully so, because they're extremely toxic. Become the enemy. Just a whiff is debilitating. The hypervigilance required makes it so much more difficult to operate. Where are you going? To the house of a friend who uses conventional toxic cleaners, a plug-in air freshener, and chemically treated potpourri? How are you going to function? There's an activator around every corner. Even Christmas trees are sprayed with a concoction to keep them green as long as possible. Even fake Christmas trees are treated with nanotechnology solutions that can set someone off. Those who are chemically sensitive are forced to become experts and always be mindful. What they view through their eyes is an entirely different world from what someone else may see. Anyone with chemical or food sensitivities has had to leave behind their rose-coloured glasses. They must dedicate an immense amount of energy and time to reading labels, finding out what's truly in every product they come across, and researching ingredients' origins. They must be cautious about new carpets and furniture, as well as home products that involve paint, cork, lubricant, or sealant. They must call ahead to hotels with special requests for hypoallergenic rooms, still with no guarantee that upon opening that hotel room door, they won't be blasted with scent. Some chemical sensitivity sufferers are better educated than engineers and even chemists. While a chemist may be at the highest level in her area of expertise, she may also be wearing clothes saturated with multiple synthetic laundry chemicals, use air fresheners leaching out oils with unknown effects on humans, and hop in her car that was just detailed and wiped down with chemicals to make the leather shine and outfitted with its own dangling air freshener. Then that weekend she may decide to paint her house with high VOC paint and later pour gasoline into her lawnmower, spill some on her hands, then mow the lawn and breathe in the exhaust. The chemically sensitive person is actually better versed
in all the harmful exposures to which the chemist has just subjected herself. If someone mentioned the exposures to the chemist, she may say, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." That may make sense in other areas of life, not in this one. Those who are newly chemically sensitive have a very tough time of it. First, there's the process of becoming aware that something's wrong. It can create a tremendous amount of confusion. Headaches for the first time in your life, a funny taste in your mouth or a tingly tongue in certain settings, getting tired easily while walking through a department store and breathing in thousands of synthetic chemicals, or starting to feel a tight chest in the workplace from fragrances in the air, day in and day out. These aren't fun symptoms to develop. Newbies have a difficult challenge, both with finding a doctor who doesn't say, "It's all in your head," or want to shove you in the Lyme disease trap, and with finding support from family and friends who may be bewildered or become sick of it all quite fast since everything was fine before. Your bodily reactions aren't easy, and neither are the reactions you get from others. Why can't you be like everyone else in the world who's living life, putting on makeup and perfume, or cologne and aftershave, going to the salon, breathing in car exhaust and shopping at the mall with no complaints? For anyone who's navigating a fresh sensitivity, this new reality can feel very limiting. Then we have the people who are already experts. They discovered their sensitivities years ago. They know what they can and can't handle. They know what boundaries they can push, and still, it's unpredictable. They can go through times of feeling better and handling more, and then waves of being able to tolerate less. It's a game of chance. We can't confuse chemical sensitivities with reactions to obviously harmful chemicals. We're not talking here about highly regulated chemicals, like those known to visibly burn the skin. We're talking about substances you can't see, hear or feel, ones that many people can't even smell. How does someone develop a sensitivity to the invisible? What occurs? It all stems from the liver, and that's one truth that not even chemically sensitive people know yet. All sufferers have their guesses about why it happened to them. They often have a landmark. Some people believe it all started the day they got sprayed by a pesticide while walking through a condominium park. Some people think it started the day they ate a certain food. Some say it was the day they had their house painted. Yes, these experiences can be triggers, and the realization that something's wrong can occur at these times. They aren't the whole story, though. What about the other person who got sprayed walking through the condo park that day? And not only was he fine, he went to the hardware store, purchased his own pesticides, sprayed them on his own lawn, and didn't develop a chemical sensitivity. Maybe it could happen down the road for him, though not yet. That wasn't his landmark. For the person who did develop a sensitivity, it was about what was going on internally. The timing of that day in the park was random. The sensitivity was going to happen anyway. It had already begun. Chemical sensitivity secrets. It all starts with the liver, the big sponge of the body whose job it is to collect, catalogue and keep in check thousands of troublemakers, both from the outside world and created within your body in order to shield you. It's natural for the body to create toxic substances. For example, when you experience fear, the adrenals pump out that form of adrenaline that helps with survival in the moment and yet is so potent that the liver must clean it up as soon as it's done its job in order to protect the rest of your body from its caustic nature. We also eat foods with ingredients that are hard on the liver, whether toxic grease or invisible toxic chemicals. On cruise ships, the food is sprayed down with chemical agents to preserve it, and our livers must contend with that. Any type of drugs we ingest or shots we receive, going all the way back to antibiotics taken in childhood, give the liver more to process and contain. Pathogens, including EBV, find their way inside the liver, make a home, and create a mess all on their own, releasing waste matter, such as dermatoxins, neurotoxins, and byproduct. With all these troublemakers and more, your liver is in a constant ratio game. How much is coming in through the air you breathe, and the germs you're exposed to, and the rogue viral toxins that have escaped back into the bloodstream, and the foods, drinks, and medicines you ingest? How much can the liver afford to let go for elimination from your body, released when you go to the bathroom without overloading your system? That ratio of what's going into the liver versus what can go out is forever in play. For many people, there aren't a lot of toxins leaving. The liver is sluggish, the colon is already dirty, and yet more poisons keep coming in from toxic food sources. Fresh paint, a visit to a store filled with scented candles, an air freshener plugged into a dentist's waiting room wall, a delivery truck spewing exhaust as it idles in your driveway, the carpet cleaning in your office over the weekend, the fire-retardant chemicals sprayed on new clothes you just bought. The liver can't let go as fast as the poisons enter. Then a trigger finally pushes the liver over the edge. It could be a visit to the dentist's office to get a mercury filling drilled out, which outgasses mercury into your system. For more on this, see Medical Medium. It could be that walk through the condo park, getting hit with toxic weed killer. When the body has reached this too toxic place, over time, and the liver has grown too sluggish to keep it all in check, again over time, chemical sensitivity starts. The final triggers aren't the cause, they're the liver's last straw. A sensitive central nervous system is behind chemical sensitivities. Toxins that the liver can't neutralize or contain overload the nervous system to the point that it eventually becomes sensitive or even allergic to certain poisons. This can take the form of funny feelings in the mouth, the sense that you can't breathe deeply or right, blurry eyes, chronic headaches or migraines, fatigue, tingles and numbness, insomnia, dizziness, anxiety, depression and more. Some of these symptoms can happen independently, for example, as a result of EBV neurotoxins going after the nervous system. Chemical sensitivity can also cause all of it. If the liver weren't already overloaded and the scale weren't tipped so much, and if a given person didn't have an active EBV infection or another major problem, then a chemical sensitivity wouldn't develop from one bad encounter. The switch would not be flipped. Often, neurotoxins and dermatoxins from EBV combined with certain toxins stored inside the liver create chemical sensitivities. For a person who has EBV without the right kind of toxic heavy metals or pesticides in the liver, a chemical sensitivity may not develop. While she or he may deal with a sensitive central nervous system from the virus, that individual won't have the chemical sensitivity component. Neurotoxins and dermatoxins excreted by EBV that's consuming the right kind of poisons in the liver, on the other hand, weaken the nervous system further. They give someone extra eye sensitivities, including light sensitivity, brain fog, dizziness, tingles on the tongue and numbness in the hands. People will think it's the chemicals they just breathed in, the incense in a store or air freshener in a bathroom, or cloud of hairspray at the salon, directly causing this. In reality, the virus system has already fed off enough poisons in the liver to make them sensitive. So when there's an outside stimulus like a synthetic fragrance, the nervous system
reacts instantly. This unknown combination of factors happening beneath the surface really confuses medical research and science when they try to figure out the causes of chemical sensitivities. Doctors and other practitioners need to keep an open mind and learn that in most chemical sensitivity patients, the central nervous system is weakened and a viral infection could be playing a very large part in that. Not every chemically sensitive person is dealing with an active viral infection. Many have been sprayed or injured by certain chemicals, and the body has developed a hyper-awareness, causing the hypersensitivity sensations. All of the above is why two different people can have two wildly different outcomes from the same exposure. It all depends on where someone is in her or his life in that moment, how much burden is on the liver, how limited the liver has become in eliminating poisons, what kind of viral activity is present, and how sensitive the person has become without knowing it. Many people can have a chemical sensitivity for a long time before they realize what's going on. When a sensitivity makes itself known, an emotional component kicks in that makes the physical suffering harder. What could trigger it next? Is it getting better? Worse? Am I dying? Many people can't put a finger on what that final push into sensitivity was, and that mystery makes it tough too. Fear heightens, and a form of obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, develops from what they go through. Freedom comes from knowing that it's not a single or silent trigger that turns your life upside down overnight. It's a slow build, which means it can be deconstructed. Healing from chemical sensitivities is about patience and understanding. It takes two focuses: caring for the liver and caring for the nervous system. I'm not blind to the fact that chemically sensitive people have difficulty detoxing. Many can't even take a single supplement in order to try to soothe the nervous system or detox the liver, because they're so sensitive. If this is you, don't think you're stuck. Food is the answer in this case. Take care of your liver and nervous system carefully with food. Food sensitivity secrets. If you're someone with a lot of food reactions, I know what a difficult time you have of it. Every day, it must seem, a food you used to be okay with gives you a funny new sensation. Many people are told this is mold-related, when the reality is that, yet again, it's a viral issue heightening chemical sensitivities. That is, an abundance of EBV neurotoxins taking chemical sensitivities to a new level. In some cases, it's because the food itself is viral fuel. If it's a troublemaker food, it can feed EBV, creating more neurotoxins that inflame the digestive tract. People with a hyper